Let's restart by doing a few minutes of meditation. So first just seat yourself comfortably. Sit up straight and relax. Just let your mind be. Don't follow the tracks of the past. Don't anticipate the future. Just rest in the present, unaltered, ordinary mind. Being Dharma practitioners, we should advise non-Dharmic people. Don't do that, practice Dharma, and so forth. We should advise those who are Dharmic that sentient beings should train in the higher qualities. It is better to keep discipline than to practice generosity. Meditation is better than studying, and so forth. It is necessary to train in these higher qualities. When I say this, some people say, while we are ordinary beings, we cannot develop what is taught in the Dharma in our beings. Now we are so-called aspiring practitioners. So So you might think, oh, come on, everything that Milarepa did, you know, all the things that people do, that happened in the past. People can't achieve enlightenment anymore. We can't achieve enlightenment anymore. It's like, you know, a myth. We can't do that. Now the only thing we can do is, like, make prayers. Maybe like that in the future sometime. If it won't arise in your beings now, it will be even less likely to arise if you are born a dog in your next life. It is less likely still if you are reborn as an ox, donkey, or animal, or in some other, or in another of the eight states that lack leisure. Even now, you cannot get your mind to do anything if your body is even slightly indisposed. So I think there is no better time than now to practice Dharma. It is always difficult to be an accomplished master or perfect. Now we must go on our aspirations. We have to make the aspirations down. We have to act upon our aspirations now. It's not enough to say, oh, in the future maybe I become a Buddha to help all beings. That's my bodhicitta. I'm going to go off and go to work. Leave the bodhicitta behind. It doesn't work. And you have to really, if you're going to make that aspiration, may I become a Buddha, you have to act on it now, because we have no idea what is going to happen next. So, you know, we die and we're reborn. If we're lucky, we're reborn human, but there's no guarantee of that. So, if you're going to do something, if you're going to do something good, you do it when you have the opportunity to do it. If you want to practice generosity, you have to be generous when there's someone to be generous to, and when you are able to be generous. If you walk by that beggar thinking, oh, I'll give him something tomorrow. Tomorrow they might not be there. So now's the time to act. Now, if we're going to, in practicing Dharma, we first practice generosity, then we practice discipline, then patience, diligence, jhana, full one-pointed meditation, and prajna. We have to go through all of these steps. We have to do it now, because we don't know what's going to happen next. When it talks about training in the higher qualities, though, you have to keep in mind that what is a higher quality in general is not necessarily a higher quality in particular. And generosity is like a beginner's dharma. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't practice it, because actually it may be more beneficial for you to practice generosity than it is for you to practice meditation. It might be more beneficial for you to study than to meditate, even though meditation is higher than studying. You have to do what's appropriate for you at that time. You have to do the right practice at the time. If you try to meditate before you even studied, then you're like, it's like tying your hands behind your back when you go rock climbing. So you gotta practice what's appropriate for you at this point. But on the other hand, you shouldn't get complacent and say, oh, I can't do that. It's not me. You can actually develop yourself. You can push yourself a little bit, but you have to make sure to do the so-called lower practices before you get to the higher practices. And for us as beginners, the lower practices are more beneficial. The reason for this is that the higher practices, you start with a completely different way of looking at life. Real Mahamudra is completely different than our way. It's a very different way of looking at the world. It's too far. You can't just I'm going to step from my worldly attitude to Mahamudra. It's hard. Very few people can actually do that. So you have to go step by step. So instead of thinking about that, well, then we have to go through, you think about the precious opportunity of this human life, the precious human birth. That's something that's close enough to our worldly attitude that we can actually take that step. Then once you've taken that step and really consolidated it by thinking about it and contemplating it, even after you think you've already got it, until it really permeates your being, then you can start thinking about impermanence. This human life is not going to last very long. I've got to really make use of it now. Actually, if you understand the precious human body, you really understand quite a bit about impermanence already. When you understand impermanence, you actually understand a lot about emptiness. But you really have to contemplate it over and over again. And going through these steps helps us go step by step. Because, you know, if you're climbing stairs, you go one step at a time. Some people can go two. Little kids try to go three. But really, it's going one step at a time. That's how you get up to the top of the staircase or the top of the ladder. So we've got the same thing to do here. We've got to go one step at a time. So we've got to contemplate that human, precious human birth of the leisures and resources and really take it to heart. And then we can actually do it. If you've gotten yourself into doing the preliminary practices and you don't feel like you're able to finish them, you got to keep going with them. Because once you start, you should not finish, or you should not stop. Once you start something, you need to finish, and you can't let it go. But you need to put more emphasis onto thinking about the precious human body, impermanence, and so forth. If you think about those all the time that you can outside of your practice, then your practice will go a lot better. You will actually be able to finish them. So Mara does not mean some external dark-skinned or grotesque being. It means the inability to develop the higher qualities despite your own good intentions and good compassion. This is Tracy's question. Basically, what can we do about that? Because we have so much habituation from the past. This is why we need to contemplate the four thoughts that turn the mind over and over again. And the more we talk about that, I'm a broken record today, I'm sorry. There's just no other way to go through this. We just have to hear it. And there's no way to be subtle about this. If you do not contemplate the four thoughts that turn the mind, you will be attached. Mara basically means our own attachment. And the most subtle of the Maras is the child of the gods. The Mara of the child of the gods. It seems so nice and so lovely, and it feels so right. You fall in love. Coffee. Whatever. It's like, I gotta have that. It's like, or you see this photograph, it's like, wow, that's beautiful. And then you get attached to it, and it stops you from doing something. You think, I've gotta do this. Gelato, this place. My friend told me about this place in Portland that has an award that people come from all over. People come from New York to get coffee at the Speckled Axe. People drive from Connecticut to the Montpelier Food Co-op to buy beer. Come on. How much time have they wasted? Not to mention gas. And how much, but more importantly, how much time are we wasting on our own attachments? That's what you really have to look at. And look at the life stories of the great masters. Okay. Milarepa. What did Milarepa do? He first murdered 36 people. So, okay. Then he feels really bad. And he knows that he's going to hell because he has murdered 36 people unless he achieves Buddhahood in this lifetime. And that's why he's willing to go through everything. But even after that, he's continually contemplating impermanence. People think that the lesson of Milarepa is that you have to wear a white robe and sit in mountain caves. That is not the lesson of Milarepa. The lesson of Milarepa is that you have to take impermanence to heart, and if you do, you can achieve Buddhahood in this lifetime. If you don't take impermanence to heart, you aren't going to be able to do it. Marpa the translator, especially, you know, often held up, Rinpoche always holds up Rinpoche, Marpa the translator, as an example of practicing Mahamudra as a layperson. But what was most important to Marpa? When he was aged and he knew that there was an instruction he had to go to get from India, what did he do? He went back to India. Incredibly dangerous. There was no way to get from Tibet to India without risking your life. It's hard enough to do it as a young man, but to do it the third time that Marpa did it, he was already old. He was already in his 50s or 60s, which is really old in Tibet. I mean, here it's not so old, but you see, if Tibetans were 50s or 60s, they figure that their life is just about over. And it was even that way back, you know, time of Marpa. And yet, despite that, he went to India. His entire family, all of his students were saying, don't go, and he went anyways. Are we willing to do that? So if we're still so attached to our daily lives, That is the Mara that is preventing us from achieving Buddhahood in this life. That's what we mean when they talk about Maras in Buddhism. It's not someone outside, not some bogeyman living in some little hut. You walk by that abandoned hut in that dark corner. Don't go by there on the full moon. I'm sorry, that's not the Mara. I have understood that remembering death alone is the critical point for practicing Dharma from your heart. If you do not recall death, all your listening, contemplating, and meditating, and all the difficult austerities such as mountain retreats, sealed retreats, alms, solitude, eating only once per day, and so forth that you do will go toward how much merit you can generate for this life, how much people will respect you, how much gain in fortune will come, how much gain in fame will come in your ambitions for this life. They will not become the Dharma. If water does not enter the top of the channel, it will not come out the bottom. If the arrow has no nock, you can load the bow and shoot it anyways, but it will not go where you want it to. Similarly, Dharma cannot become the path if you do not remember death. So as I mentioned before, the nock on an arrow is the slit at the back that you put on the string. If there's no slit on the arrow, you can't shoot it. Sort of like, what would you say? It's like your rifle that doesn't know where the barrel is not scored so that to make the bullet rotate. You know, if you want to shoot a straight arrow, you've got to have that nock. You've got to have the rifling and the bore of the gun. Otherwise, the arrow won't go, or the bullet won't go. I have had some experience in the meantime. When you truly remember from your heart that you will die, you will be able to give up on this life. For the first time, you have laid the genuine foundation for the Dharma. You have reached the beginning of the path. It's not the end, it's the beginning. Actually, when you think about, when you listen to the classic teachings of what a Dharma practitioner, the teachings from Atisha's teachings on the three types of individuals, the lesser type of individuals are those individuals who want to achieve a state, one of the happy states of gods or of being born as a god or human in the next life. We just want to feel good now. Forget about the next life. We might as well get a massage. Take your OxyContin. The water has entered the top of the channel. You will not have difficulty developing qualities. You will have good internal cause for it, so you will not practice the Dharma properly, and adversity will be unable to impede you. In Nepal, the retreat master at our retreat center, we have a three retreat center for monks, and there's also a retreat center for foreigners who come, and there are quite a few who are doing a retreat. It's full and hard to find places, I'm sorry to say. He has started a new program for his foreign disciples, Kenpo Fabu. 6 years of retreat, 1 year meditating on the precious human life, 1 year meditating on impermanence, 1 year meditating on karmic cause and effect, and 1 year meditating on the defects of samsara. And this is meditating from 4 in the morning until 10 at night, every day, with no holidays, for 4 years, and then you can begin practicing Mahamudra. That's the beginning. This is what we have to do, but you can do it. You have to do what Rinpoche says. Rinpoche always quotes Milarepa, who said, you know, I've never studied texts in ink. I take all that appears and exists as my books. So you just got to look around you, but you have to look carefully at what's happening in your life and see what is going on. You know, like we started out looking about, thinking about people you know in nursing home or whatever situation. Think about your parents. Think about your grandparents. Think about your friends. Think about the people who've passed away. Think about the people who almost passed away. Think about the time you almost got hit by the truck. That far, I wouldn't be here if it weren't for that much space. Probably more often than I realized, too. That's the other thing that really occurred to me. So it's just, it's a miracle that we're here. And since we have that miracle has come together, the conditions have come together now, we need to take advantage of them now. Where did I get to? You will be able to practice as taught in the Dharma. If you do not turn away your mind away from this life, you may be able to explain everything found in Dharma texts or enter the gate of the Mahayana secret mantra and practice unified non-duality, but you will not be any different from an ordinary layperson. So no matter how learned you are, if you don't take this to heart, it doesn't matter. You may think you're doing Mahamudra practice, but if you have still attached to this life, I'm sorry, it's probably not. It's not going to be so helpful. You've got to really work with your... You've got to really see your attachments and see how they impede you and contemplate this and think about impermanence, the great opportunity that we have. If you do that, your practice will go well. So for this reason, Lord Atisha, summing up the essential meaning of all the scriptures, taught the three types of persons, the lesser, middling, and greater. Among those, the lesser type of person turns their mind away from this life and practices the Dharma from fear of the lower realms in the next life. But there is no way to bring people to develop with themselves even the qualities of a lesser person. This is because people make a dharmic connection such as refuge or bodhicitta with a spiritual friend, but later they will not call him their master out of respect. They think that if they call him their master, others will criticize them, and so they keep it secret. If someone asks them, isn't that your master? They reply, oh, I only took refuge in bodhicitta with him. This is failing to understand that refuge and bodhicitta are the root of the entire Dharma, so it is an extremely grave fault. So when you do take teachings or make some sort of a Dharma connection, and here the example given is of refuge and bodhicitta, but any teaching you take from someone, any Dharma teaching you take, you really need to value. It's so easy for us to look and see the bad in other people. It's important for us to look and see the good in other people. So it's not just, you know, I mean, it's not me, but you're looking at other people. When you hear people in your community, you know, discussing things, and someone's going to say something good, you shouldn't discount it just because, oh, yeah, they said it. I don't know. Actually, you should really respect each other and try to get along. What's most important in any Dharma group is, first of all, that you get along and that you're harmonious. You're a single group, a single Dharma center, and so you all need to get along. This is the most important thing you can do. Because anything else, I mean, if you don't get along, people will walk through the door and they'll sense it. They'll know, oh, there's something funny in that room. There's some tension between those people. I don't want to know the story. I'm not coming back. You need to make sure that you're harmonious with yourselves and that you're welcoming to people. So when people come, you need to take good care of them. Make sure that they feel like they're welcome. Some Dharma centers accomplish this through tea and cookies, but it's not necessary to put out tea and cookies, although sometimes it helps. but to just to make people feel like they're welcome and that they're here, and then amongst yourselves to really try to be harmonious and get along with each other. So that's really important. So I have found qualities in every word spoken by those from whom I have received the Dharma. The only thought that has occurred to me is that I could never buy it for money. Thus there are very few who have turned their minds away from this life. Many say they are bodhisattvas, but I wonder whether they are really focused on this life. I think about what I would do if I were to die tonight, and have never considered any ambitions for tomorrow and the thereafter. At the time of the Buddha, there was the son of a wealthy merchant. I don't remember his name, I'm sorry. I looked it up again and then I forgot it again. He was very wealthy. He had all sorts of jewels and wealth and servants and everything, a lot of land. He built himself three houses. Built himself a winter house, a summer house, and the winter house, the spring house, and the summer house. And then he died. He didn't get to use any of them. And the Buddha heard about this, and the Buddha said, I shall do that in winter time, in springtime, or in summer. This is how the childish think, but they don't see what intervenes. We can make lots of plans for the future, but, you know, we just don't know, are we going to get there or not? So, So where you are now, it's not. This is not to say you should stop making contributions to your 501c, what is it, 513c3 or whatever, the C3KX2. I don't know. It's been so long since I've worried about that sort of thing. I don't remember the numbers. But it's not saying that you should stop making contribution to that tomorrow. Because like as Steve mentioned, you are living in a worldly life. But the important thing is that you take the opportunity to really contemplate these four reminders every moment you can get. One thing you can do that the Gyawan Karmapa has taught on many occasions is you can look at each day as an entire lifetime. You wake up in the morning and you think to yourself, I've been born. So waking up, that's infancy. Washing your faith is like being a toddler. Then getting up and having breakfast is like going to grade school. Then, you know, going to work is like high school. Then the first few hours of work is like college. And then you're adult. And you come home and it's like the twilight years, the golden years, whatever you want to call it. And when you go to bed, you think to yourself that you're lying down in your bed dead and dying. So you rehearse every day as like an entire lifetime, from birth to death. And if you do this, you will. This is a technique from the old Kadampa masters. So you take each day as an entire death. And it's not like you're thinking about this the entire day. Okay, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so now I'm 63 years old. That's not necessary, but you can think about it as just in general, thinking about it. Okay, now the day is ending. Now this lifetime of this day is coming to an end. Our births and our deaths are happening in every moment. Every moment, everything is coming together, arising, and perishing. Arising, perishing in every single moment. So every moment is a birth and a death. Every day is a birth and a death. The point is that each moment is an opportunity. Each lifetime is an opportunity. And this moment, this lifetime right now, is an opportunity for us to practice the Dharma. Because of that, I have understood the critical points of Dharma. That alone is the greatest sustenance for meditation. I thought it would be so for others, but when I tell them, their attitudes have never been compatible with mine. They worry about me, and I get discouraged about them. Generally, if you do not have some conviction, even knowing a lot of Dharma will not help. They worry that I won't perfect the accumulations and say, aren't you being a bit extreme to make me regret it? Perfecting the accumulations, and in particular what the people mean is like, oh, you have to be generous. You have to have things if you're going to give things away, they think. You have to have money if you want to be able to be generous. Generosity isn't about money. Generosity is about your attitude. The greatest acts of generosity are sometimes ones that, you know, qualify as paltry by the standards of most philanthropists. And you can have make a huge donation, but if you give it with pride, it's not worth salt. So you gotta, you know, it's most important is that you give with a pure heart. Generosity is the wish to give. So keep that in mind and practice generosity, but that doesn't mean that you need to make yourself wealthy so that you can start a foundation. And only then be generous. You can be generous right now, and you should be generous right now. Actually, generosity is an incredibly powerful and important practice for us. Because so often we close ourselves off. You know, walking through Portland, there are a few people on the street panhandling. Normally we might think to ourselves, oh, you know, I can't help them. If I give them a dollar, they're just going to drink it away. That's why I gave the guy 18 cents yesterday. Can't drink much with 18 cents. But as I saw all the change that I had in my pocket too. But you know, it actually makes a big difference when you practice when you think, I'm not going to give to this person because of this reason. Are you really not giving it to them because of that reason, or are you just being stingy and have an excuse? You need to look at yourself. If you look at yourself and you see, I'm being stingy and using my conception of that other person as an excuse for not giving, then you're just being stingy, and it's probably better to give. If you understand that giving to this person is not going to help them, but you're going to support the organization that will give them the help that they need, then that's also good generosity. That's using wisdom and intelligence. But sometimes it's also fine to give a panhandler a dollar. Maybe I'm cheap giving him 18 cents. But he was already drunk. Isn't that one of the black dharmas, making someone regret something they should not regret? The sutras say that if you rejoice in the virtue another has done, you gain half the virtue. Do they not understand that? So people who say to Potowa, oh, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't practice. Actually, they may think they're acting out of concern, but really they're actually not. They're acting out of their own attachments. So you should rejoice. When you see other people doing things, people may give away crazy things, and you wonder, why the heck are they doing that? But you should rejoice in the good things that other people do, even if it seems like over the top. When I say that, some people say, we are not saying you are wrong, we are giving you advice from concern. It depresses me that concerned people give such advice. It is evidence that they have no other thought than that. I find it astounding. In actuality, they are saying, do whatever you can not to be liberated from samsara. Even if they are concerned, I will not listen. I have made Dharma connections with some who are said to be great meditators or venerable scholars with great knowledge of the Dharma. With some of them, when we tell each other our stories, our attitudes have not been at all compatible. I felt no desire to converse freely with them and let them prattle on as they wish. Even those said to be good practitioners gather enough food and clothing so that they will not depend on anyone else, saying, I don't want to depend on anyone for food in this life. They think they will go stay in a monastery in some fine valley where there is no need to accumulate misdeeds and do as much spiritual practice as they can. They're no more than just one or two practitioners who think, let this life turn out as it will. This is like the ideal that we want to get towards. Saying that it's the ideal that we want to get towards doesn't mean that it's some unattainable goal. There are people who do this. There are people who spend a lot of time in retreat. And it's not that they're in appreciably different circumstances than us. It's that they've decided to do it. It's motivation. If you have the motivation to do something, it'll work out. You know, the worldly way of saying it is, do what you want and the money will follow. Okay. Do what's really important and life will take care of itself. There's the advice from the yogi that came out last year in Rinpoche's book and the verse in there by Padampa Sangye says, whatever occurs in this life, you'll have, what is it? Whatever occurs in this life, you'll have food and drink enough. You'll be okay. It'll work out. We don't need to be quite so, you know, comfortable as we are. But you have to have the right motivation first. So this is where you can't go straightly from this to the mountain cave, or from where we are to the mountain cave, but we can take the steps of thinking about impermanence. Even if you don't get to the point where you are able to go off and devote your life to retreat and all that in this lifetime, it will help you. So the most helpful thing you can do is think about the four things that turn the mind. In my opinion, we must flee the suffering of samsara that is to be eliminated. We must accumulate incalculable accumulations to achieve the result, perfect Buddhahood. I think we must practice whatever is said to be the greatest merit. If even when selling something such as woolen cloth, we let the other win by 4 or 5 pounds without them knowing, I think that will bring great merit. We're often really worried about, I got cheated. Okay, you say you're bodhisattvas, you want to give everything away, and then you are worried about getting cheated? You've just given something away. Why are you upset about it? You want to give things away, you want to help other people, and you feel cheated? What's your problem? Come on, basically. And people really do think about this. Oh, or you know, when you're engaging in business, like, oh, you could have got a better price than that. So what? It doesn't matter. It makes no difference at all. When I say this, others say it is taking a loss without any return. It would be better to give, they say. Dharma practitioners should not actually want any return and should take delight when other beings who are like their father and mother win instead of themselves. If they are not like that, there is no way they will awaken to Buddhahood. It is also the opposite of meditating on the four immeasurables. In order to achieve Buddhahood, you should be able to give away even your body and life if it will benefit sentient beings, not to mention giving away possessions. How could a practitioner who loses a couple nights' sleep when they suffer a small loss on their merchandise help anyone else? They're causing themselves great harm. For example, when people offer tea to the monks of one valley on one morning, someone else might say they have gained merit, and they will think that they have done something virtuous. But then they stay in a valley or a monastery where many people have gathered. They buy when goods are plentiful and sell when they are scarce. They do not sell at the going rates or use quarts, ounces, or accepted measures. They keep on pushing until they achieve their wishes, not giving up until others are left powerless and unhappy and their own hopes are fulfilled. This is not just one or two people. It is all beings in the 10 directions. It is not just for one day, one month, or one year. They do it their whole lives. In brief, they feel good if they do something virtuous for one morning, but do not feel even a moment's discomfort for spending their entire lives accumulating misdeeds. I wonder what kind of a mind they have. What assurance could they have? I think 12th century, 11th and 12th century Tibet was obviously a very different place than 20th century Portland. And I think that for most of us, particularly people who come to places like this, I think that actually one of the real strengths about the culture that we grew up in is that we really grew up and we learn how to be ethical people. It's really taught, inculcated in a lot of people very strongly in this culture, and more than we realize. I mean, I think Buddhists, sometimes you read in Buddhist texts, if you don't remember about past and future lives, you can't practice ethics. And I sometimes wonder about that, because I do see a lot of people who behave very ethically in this life, even though they're completely materialist, and that they have a strong sense of justice, fairness, and so forth. And this is very good. One result of that is that a lot of us in our culture, we don't engage in a lot of the things that other people do, particularly a lot of the people who come to Buddhist centers, frankly. I mean, there are plenty of unscrupulous people in this country. But I think a lot of educated people in this country, and a lot of people of the class that basically all of us come from, you know, we grow up feeling that it's important to be ethical. So on the one hand, when you think about a teaching like this, okay, you think to yourself, well, I haven't spent my whole life accumulating misdeeds. I've tried to be a good person. I've gone into a profession that helps people, teaching or medicine or therapy or whatever. We do things that, you know, we haven't murdered anyone, maybe. So how do we work with this idea? For us, I think the bigger problem, rather than the misdeeds of body and speech, the misdeeds of the body are the misdeeds of speech. You think about, how do we speak about things? When we speak about people, do we speak about them well, or do we speak about them badly? How many times have you told white lies? Not for any beneficial purpose, but maybe just to sort of not share some secret about yourself. You don't want people to know that you have done something embarrassing in the past, so you tell a white lie to cover it up. I think this is pretty common. And when we talk with friends and family, how much of our time is actually spent gossiping in a kind of negative way about people? So for us, you know, I think for most of us, probably cheating on weights and measures. It could happen. There could be some shoplifters in this room. They'd actually be surprised at who shoplifts. And if it's one of, you know, if it's you, then you know it's yourself. If it's not you, you might think it's the person next to you. But you shouldn't think about that. You need to think about your own life. You need to look at yourself. So whether or not you've spent your time accumulating misdeeds, have you really been as good as you think you can have been? Is doing that one good thing that you pride yourself for, does that make up for all those other moments of just being neutral? Is that enough? This is what we really have to, I mean, you have to make sure that if we're going to accumulate merit, that means that we're creating habits to do good, that we're training ourselves to do good. And if we're actually training ourselves to just sort of be blasé and watch Netflix and drink coffee, even at the Speckled Axe, I mean, what, you know, what good does this do us? So we have to look at our lives. And so this is, you know, just, again, looking at yourself, looking honestly at yourself. And the most important thing we can do. What assurance could they have? So assurance, the assurance that we need is assurance that when we die, that we're going to be able to at best achieve liberation at the moment of death. Second best would be to achieve liberation in the bardo or in a pure realm. And the third best is to be reborn in a precious human body where we can practice dharma again. And so how confident, you know, you have to, how confident are you? You know, you have to think, and that, how can you tell if you have confidence or not? Well, sort of think to yourself, what do you normally, if you think about, maybe we should do it right now, let's just spend a couple minutes considering what are the type of thoughts that normally come to your mind. What do you normally think about? How often do you think about love? How often do you think about being annoyed? How often do you think about food or beverage? How often do you feel proud of yourself? How often do you think critically of others? What sort of thoughts think come to your mind? So just spend a few moments thinking about this. So when you look back at the types of things that you think about, if you think about find yourself thinking a lot about how can I liberate myself from samsara? Bodhicitta, compassion, unbiased compassion. How much of your thought is like that? How much of your thought is criticizing? How much of your thought is about things that you don't like, that you want to get rid of? How much of your thought is neutral? How much of it is getting upset about the election? This is a big one. It's just hard not to do that this year, no matter which candidate you like or don't like or like less. So when you look at that, you can balance the thoughts that we can rely on at the time of death are the thoughts of bodhicitta, the wish for liberation from samsara, unbiased compassion, and loving kindness. Everything else is fair game. Who knows what's going to happen? If you find yourself in your daily life just reverting to negative or neutral mind states, is it going to be any better at the time of your death? I mean, of course, the moment of death is a particular instant. And you might be fortunate that you'll have some sort of a death that you can prepare for, and you can spend your time surrounded by loved ones dying a peaceful death, and be a calm and happy mind. But you might have gone senile first. You might have a death in agony, or you might be so doped up on opioids that you can't think about anything. Or you could just have a sudden death. You might be murdered. Maybe even by your own children. Who knows? At any rate, at the time of death, there's the attitude, the thought that takes over is the one that's going to determine what comes next. And so, if you train yourself now, if we train ourselves now to have positive dharmic thoughts, unbiased love and compassion, bodhicitta, then at the time of death, I think we've got a chance. Other than that, we're putting ourselves at the mercy of, do we know someone who can get a message to Rinpoche and the Karmapa, frankly. Otherwise, there's no hope for us on our own. We're New Englanders, we've got to be self-reliant, you know? So, that's the... I think that's maybe enough of the text for this morning. But maybe you all have some questions. Some concerns. Something. Yes?
I think my way of operating in the world and with practice, this may be slightly distorted and mistaken, but I've always thought of dropping out of the world as being more of a Hinayana type practice. So being in deep retreat, cave, being focused on one's own enlightenment. And then I guess my rationalization for being in the world is that it's a Mahayana outlook where the world becomes a form of practice and trying to be mindful of things like moments and working with worldly situations. But I know that there are pitfalls, and I know that it's probably a question of what is most appropriate at a point in time in one's own life. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is, is there any accuracy in the way I'm thinking about this, or is it, totally off. Just this kind of approach.
So is being mindful of situations around you, is that a Mahayana attitude?
It seems necessary to, in order for difficult situations which present themselves in the world, in, you know, a sort of start situation, it seems that mindfulness is almost like a prerequisite for being able to work with.
That's right. So it's like a prerequisite, but is it what makes a Mahayana attitude?
No, I think compassion.
But compassion is also very strong in the Theravada tradition. So what's the difference between the Theravada compassion and the Mahayana compassion?
That's a good question.
If you are able to work in the world with continual mindfulness of this being that I am seeing right now is a Buddha, but does not realize it, I need to do what I can to help him come to Buddhahood. If you think to yourself that you really want, not just that you sort of think it would be nice, that you really want to become a Buddha to free all beings from samsara, if you have the attitude of bodhicitta, then you're working with the world in the Mahayana way. But we have to get there. And it's very difficult to develop this attitude when we're continually distracted by presidential elections, whatever. The great masters of Tibet, definitely Mahayana, the previous Kala Rinpoche spent 30 years in retreat. 30 years. The previous Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche also spent decades in retreat. And because of doing that, look at what they're able to do to benefit beings. So going in retreat is not saying I'm running away from the world, it's saying I gotta practice. It's like, so if you're gonna become, if you think I wanna become a doctor, do you go out and open up a storefront and start treating people for sickness? No. You go to medical school. You go through a residency. You get ground into dirt during a residency, and then you're a doctor. It's the same thing with meditation. As beginners, we don't have the strength to be able to do it in society, really. So we have to do something to prepare ourselves, and that means often going into retreat. So we have to get ourselves to be ready to go into retreat. And that means contemplating the four thoughts that turn the mind and contemplating bodhicitta. When we talk about things as Hinayana, Mahayana, we really have to take the Hinayana into... You really have to have the Hinayana attitude in order to develop the Mahayana attitude. We have to recognize that anywhere we go in samsara is suffering. And we have to want to free ourselves from that. I don't know about your particular situation, but I sometimes wonder when people say, oh, I think we should have a Mahayana attitude and work in the world. I wonder if this is just an excuse for attachment.
Yeah, I wonder that myself.
So you got to look at it. You know for yourself. Am I saying this because I am attached to my way of doing things, my way of life, and I can't picture doing something else? Or is this something that I really feel? If you are able to approach it... Now, if you find yourself on the attached... Oh, I'm really not my own. I'm actually just completely attached to this life. That's not a question for saying, therefore, I am a horrible person and should feel guilty. This is a situation where you need to say, okay, what can I do to get from where I am to where I want to go? And then you take those steps. And like I've been saying, it doesn't mean that you're going to go right off to a cave, because if you go to a cave tomorrow, you're going to get cold in January, and then you'll be done and you'll regret it. And that would be even worse than having gone in the first place. So you need to take it step by step and work through these. I mean, the other factor to keep in mind is that all of these contemplations about our own suffering, our own defects, also apply to other people. Just as we want to free ourselves from all of our own problems, other beings also want to be freed from their problems. They also want to be freed from the suffering of samsara. And we should use that to develop compassion for all sentient beings, none excepted, with no sense of, there are these beings who I feel better about and those who I don't. We should feel equal compassion, get to the point, you know, develop our compassion to the point where we can feel equal compassion for the people we like as for those we dislike. And then once we do that, then you're having a Mahayana attitude in this life is important. What's most important is that we give up on this life, stop thinking that this life is going to do something for us, and instead realize that we need to use this life not for any pleasure, but as a chance to better ourselves, and by doing so, then become able to benefit others. And you had a question also?
I do. In terms of worldly pleasures, I'm going to assume that nobody in this room is homeless. And so I happen to like gelato. And
yeah.
When I pass a gelato store, I think to myself sometimes, I have enough money to get a gelato.
Yeah.
And I have read specifically in, I think it was The Joy of Living or Joyful Wisdom by
Mingyur Rinpoche.
He said that wealth is okay, but the point is don't be attached to it.
Uh-huh.
Would you have a comment on looking at that? And also he said that it was important to have gratitude and appreciation for the worldly pleasures that we do have.
Right, so, I mean, okay, gelato, because my friend did tell me that there is an award-winning gelato store here in Portland, and I see three or four, and I don't know which one won the award, and it doesn't really matter. You have to be honest with yourself. So, If I were to go out and give a talk like this to a group of 400 or 500 or 1,000 people like Mingyur Rinpoche does, no one would come back the next day. I'm not even sure if you're going to come back after lunch. When Kempo Thabu, our retreat master in Bhaktapur, the one who did the 6-year retreat that I was mentioning, he gives a talk and he says, if you don't like it, don't come back. And a lot of people don't. And the people who stay really, you know, if you like Kempo Thabo's teaching, he's just wonderful. But in terms of your question, okay, you have wealth and that is a result of generosity in the past, according to the traditional Buddhist teachings. How long is your wealth going to last? What have you done to make sure that the next time around you're going to be okay? When you get gelato, you will have a few minutes of pleasure eating it, maybe some pleasure at remembering it later. But how much good does it do you? How much time do you have left in this life? You just have to think about that. There are people who, the reasons why, I mean, we've grown up all here, we've had this incredible fortune to be born in this incredibly prosperous place. So materially, on, you know, on a general level, with variations up and down, you know, we're all okay, at least, and some are more than okay. Is our enjoyment of pleasure preventing us from doing something that will make it possible for us to have this again in the future. So you need to ask yourself, and frankly, I mean, I myself am in a similar position, maybe not necessarily with gelato, but with other things. I find myself wasting time about things that are really unnecessary. Appreciating people, though, appreciating things, when you get that gelato, if you take the gelato or the Ethiopian natural coffee from Speckled Axe or the, you know, whatever it is that you get that you enjoy, to appreciate it, you need to really think about it. This gelato came from people who made it here in Portland. The milk came from cows. Maybe in Maine, maybe they're in Vermont, maybe they're in Wisconsin. The eggs came from chickens who are probably in cages in battery farms. The sugar came from Florida, probably, a place where they poured so many pesticides into the ecosystem. How many beings got poisoned in order for us to get this gelato? The grain that the chickens were fed, what pesticides were put on that grain? What antibiotics and things were the cows fed? Thinking of it in that way, it becomes a way for us to see that this gelato that we have, actually, this is a way for us to meditate on compassion. Because we can think about this incredible net of causes and conditions and material that all comes together to be this delicious piece of gelato, and yet, what did it come from? What suffering went through to make it? The suffering of the farmers. We can also look at it not just as compassion, but like with gelato or anything else, the food, you have a good meal, and the food all came, and the food also involves a lot of suffering. No matter what we do, the clothes we wear involve suffering. The fabric was made in a sweatshop, most likely. But it's because of those people who were living in the sweatshop, because of the plants growing and the sun and everything coming together, all these interdependent connections that come together to make our entire lives. So appreciating the gelato is like appreciating the interdependence of everything that comes together. This set of conditions came together to create something that we experience as pleasure. Sometimes the conditions come together in ways that create displeasure, like if they accidentally put salt in instead of sugar in the recipe, and you eat it and it's like, oh, this is horrible. And it's like really unpleasant. The only difference is that one is salt, one is sugar. Other than that, they're exactly the same. So when we get to the point where we look at appreciate the gelato, yes, it creates pleasure. What is the pleasure worth? What does it get you in the future? So I think when you start looking at it this way, then you'll really be able to begin to appreciate it. We are wealthy now because of what we've done in the past. The generosity we've given in the past. And so, if we can be generous of spirit and generous in whatever way we can, because, I mean, I understand when I'm saying that we're wealthy now, I also realize that there are variations in the wealth, and that some of us may have very little money that we can give away, and others of us might have quite a bit. But whether we have a little bit or a lot, if we give with that spirit of generosity, then we're doing the things that will assure that we can be prosperous in the future. If you're not prosperous, you're not going to be able to practice the Dharma, frankly. If you don't have a good enough physical situation, I mean, you've got to at least have enough food to eat to even begin thinking about practicing the Dharma. Once you're really committed to practicing the Dharma, you should practice it without caring about food or drink. But until such point as you've developed that real motivation, But you have to have food. You have to have a roof. When you truly no longer care about it, then you can go off in the cave. So right now, if you contemplate the gelato in that way, I think you'll understand a lot better what Mingyur Rinpoche really means in talking about enjoying the things of this life. I think maybe we have time for one more question before lunch. Yes.
You began today by asking us to check our intentions, and I wonder if one way to help us practice the Dharma in the in this worldly life is to be checking our intentions, not just before we meditate or whatever, but also, you know, if you're a teacher before you walk into the room, or if you're a doctor walking into to see a patient, by checking our intentions and why we're going in there in the first place, and what we're going to accomplish from that. You think that helps us be Dharma practitioners in the worldly life?
Yes, absolutely. If you are doing that, then you're actually practicing in the worldly life. The difficulty is that it's really hard for us to get to the point where we're actually, I mean, I don't know what your profession is. If you're a doctor, every time you see a patient, do you think about that? That's the point. That's the trick. That's why we need to engage in practice to train ourselves. I mean, yes, I'm talking a lot about, you know, worldly life and giving up worldly life, giving up on this life. But we do this in order to be able eventually to actually help people in this life, and that depends upon our intention. So if you can train yourself, I mean, if you are a doctor, a therapist, a massage therapist, teacher, whatever, you can think before you go in and engage the people that you're talking with that you can think, may I have a true motivation? And then as you're doing it, you also need to continually check your motivation. And then when you're done, you need to check your motivation. So, absolutely, what you're saying is 100%. It's absolutely right. The problem is that it's difficult to do it, and that's why we need to keep contemplating things like this. So I think I guess we got a couple more minutes.
It's probably a no-brainer, but just you're mentioning or reminding us of interdependence of everything. Isn't that what allows us to see a bit of nature in other people?
Yes.
Connectivity.
The interdependence is basically the same thing as emptiness, it's the same thing as Buddha nature, same thing as Mahamudra when you really see it. So even if we get a conceptual idea of it now, thinking about something like gelato or Ethiopian natural brew from Speckled Axe or whatever. My friend had it yesterday, I had tea. Even if we think about it in relation to those, then we're getting closer. But it's important to think about it. Yeah. Yes.
Just been lately kind of taking a look at the suffering in my own life,
uh-huh.
which I don't acknowledge, you know,
yeah.
realizing that there's actually, it's real. I tend to be the kind of person that thinks that everything's going pretty well, and on the surface it is, and then I
yeah.
realize that, no, there's actually a lot of suffering that we go through in this life for all these various reasons that I go through that I don't acknowledge. And then realizing that I can't really have compassion for other people and their suffering until I do that for myself. Is that sort of on track? Is that something that you would...
Compassion and renunciation are two sides of the same coin. It is by appreciating and wanting to rid yourself of your own suffering that then you're then able to understand and the suffering of others and then wish to free them from suffering others. So they're actually exactly the same thing. When we talk about it with other people, so compassion is the wish to free people from suffering and their causes, free beings from suffering and its causes. Well, when we want to free ourselves from suffering and its causes, that means, you know, renunciation. So they're exactly the same thing. It's just a question of whether we look at it or not, which direction we're looking at it. But we need to look at the suffering in our own lives to recognize that it is suffering.
Yeah.
We need to take that into account and then use that to understand others and to realize that it's not going to end unless we become Buddhists. And so we've got no choice but to do that. So I think we're coming to 11:45, at least by this clock. So before we go to lunch, we should dedicate the merit. It's easy to just sort of recite the words, so it's important to think about the meaning as we do. Thinking that because of the merit of discussing the Dharma, me teaching and you listening to the Dharma, may we all decrease our attachment to this life, become more compassionate of others, and free ourselves and all sentient beings from the oceans of samsara. So we recite the dedication of merit, which is somewhere in the chant book. Closing, last page?
Mm-hmm.
Not quite last page, almost last page. Sanam diye tam che se pa ni to ne ne be tra nam pam che ne ke ga na che pa la tro thank you.